switch things around just to accommodate people a little bit, we're going to have to end it around 11:30, because people, caucuses have been called and all that kind of things, if people want to go to those. So we're going to start, Dr. Sulik, come over. We're going to start with a discussion of some of the staff injuries at St. Peter. First, spend some time on that, and then move on to some of the redesign issues. So thank you for your flexibility here.
Yes, absolutely. The committee, I'm not sure if you want us to do any presentation of data, or if having just had a conversation with Representative Morrow, I don't know if you want to bring data up first, or how you would bring data up
first, and I'll follow up.
Because we have a slide at the very end, and I'm going to just fast forward all the way to that.
That's great.
Is it on? Yeah. Can you hear me?
I think that will work.
Okay.
More purposes of reporting.
Yeah. Great. As many of you have heard, first of all, Dr. Reed Sulik is the commissioner for the Council of Mental Health Services Administration. With me is also Mr. Michael Chesner, who's the chief executive officer for State Operated Services. One issue that we were asked to address today is specific to the Minnesota Security Hospital on the St. Peter Forensics Campus, the State Operated Forensic Services on the St. Peter Campus. There has been a relatively significant increase in injuries to staff over the last six-month period of time, at least. And this is data that I asked the staff at St. Peter to put together for us regarding the number of staff injuries. I know that there's, when we look at cumulative data over that period of the last 6 months, it certainly was very increased compared to previous periods of time. There have been a number of things that have been taken on the St. Peter campus, trying to explore what is behind the increase in the injuries. I've heard a whole array of things reported to me directly from staff, that there has been, there certainly has been an attempt to minimize the use of seclusion and restraints whenever appropriate. That process is causing a lot of angst among some staff members, feeling as if they can't use seclusion and restraints. And so what's been described to me is that there's been a number of periods of time in which staff have needed to intervene with an out-of-control patient, but have been hesitant to do so because of worry that they somehow would get into trouble. I don't know if that explains the entire process, but we're well aware that there's been an increase in staff.
And that mic is just recording, not amplifying, so I'm going to have witnesses speak up as loud as I can.
As
yeah,
as I can. I
can hear you, but I don't know.
Yes, I can do that. What I do have in front of me is actually some additional data that I asked for, literally just showing incidents across on the St. Peter campus by time of the day. There's clearly an episode in which, when we looked at this data, that there's the period of time from 2 in the afternoon until approximately 9 o'clock at night seems to be the peak hours in which staff injuries are occurring at a much higher rate than other periods of time, and particularly on Friday afternoons. Likely is that there is a shift between week staff and weekend in programming. Essentially, what has happened, up to my knowledge so far, I know that Mr. Tesner has assigned a chief operating officer down to the St. Peter campus. We have Rick Amato, who's been on the St. Peter campus since December, trying to do some pretty comprehensive analysis of, are there specific patients that are really wreaking havoc on the system, so to speak. There were key number of patients that were identified that the St. Peter campus did not appear to be well equipped to manage. And these had to do with individuals that were ordinarily not individuals that would have been previously served at St. Peter. They had, would have been previously served years ago on the Meadow campus. Several years ago, as you are well aware, Meadow started to transition some patients that were felt to be a higher acuity for them to manage to the St. Peter campus. These are individuals that, by and large, have been individuals with neurodevelopmental disorders, developmental disabilities, that have some degree of hypersensitivity to the type of environment in which they're in the environment itself, may certainly be escalating some of the aggressiveness in some of these individuals. There have been, there's been a large group of people congregated from the various programs within state-operated services, from MSOCs, from NEDO, and from the St. Peter campus, looking at transition plans for some of these individuals. Could they be better served in other programming? Two of the individuals, I believe, were just moved recently to the Pillager program, which seems to be a better model of care for those individuals. And so it is information that's being actively assessed as of today. I have been kept abreast in the last month, especially, of the fact that the injuries have continuously been occurring at a very high rate. And we've been assigning new people to the campus to try to examine them. I think that there is some difficulty that's been coming to my attention just this morning, as a matter of fact, just from a conversation with Representative Morrow, that we still need to do some examination of, do we have the right people there to really fix the issue? We'll keep looking at that. I don't know, Ms. Patezzi, we have some other additional comments. Okay. So we can open for questions.
Yeah, and when you're saying right people, are these, what level are, is this at the staffing security level, or is this at the kind of the analytical level?
The analytical level. Okay. Mr. Chair, is what I was referring to, is making sure that we have the right people who can really understand what is behind the, I mean, essentially, the staff injuries are occurring because we have patients on that campus that are escalating to the point where they are behaviorally out of control and have been aggressively acting out. There is some process that can change in regards to how that's managed, but we need to make certain that we've got the right people training staff in the right way, that the staff have a feeling of comfort, that the environment is certainly safe for them as well as for the patients that they're serving.
Are there particular parts of the facility where the injuries are occurring?
I've got that broken down by, let me see if I have that. I don't have that broken down by specific units. There was one in particular unit, which was the YAP unit, where there was a large number of the staff injuries over the last 6 months.
And what's the YAP unit?
The YAP is a young adult and adolescent program.
And where is that on the campus?
That isn't the security hospital. That is, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it appeared that certainly was...
Is that one of the older areas or the new?
In the newer building.
In the newer building.
Correct.
So with the more wide open design as opposed to the corridor design?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
We have three patients that were identified in some data that I have here in front of me. One individual was associated with 43 assaults on staff, one individual associated with 29 assaults, one individual associated with 27 assaults. When we look at that, it is clear that there are three patients essentially responsible for a total of 69% of all assaults against staff. There was another individual who was associated with 9 assaults, all against patients. And there was another individual with 5 assaults against staff, another individual with 5 assaults against staff. So you can see that there is some specificity to specific individuals that are really having a tremendously difficult time currently on that campus.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Thanks.
We have
one. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Come to order.
I'll try to keep it in order. That's not what you were saying, but thanks for coming, Dr. Sulik. Again, I am, work injuries are always a problem. I'll just look at your chart here. It's too bad there's not like a 5-year history. It'd be more interesting than a 6-month snapshot. But looking at the months in front of us, looks like OT is up when there's injuries and just remarkably high. And I know talking to some of my AMRTC folks who keep in touch with me pretty closely, they feel like they're understaffed, actually. You might want to see if the staff is in management levels or if it's in the line workers. the sense they had about staffing lately. It's been more admin and less people on the floor, as it were. Since then, they've had more administrative intermediaries than they've had in the past. So just something to, I don't know the answer, but I'm just suggesting it to you to look at that. And they also tell me that the people are getting to be more, they're more challenging people, and I know that's the design. We're trying to create more community options for the safer clients, and so as you do your redesign and think about all this, I know those are some elements you might find productive. And I know the department doesn't want to have any injuries, so I'm sure that's a concern to you, so it's nice you're here.
Can you just explain what those are, what inverse hours are?
What are forced overtime? Forced overtime. And that's the portion of the total overtime hours. And so the stress, one of the things that is making up that overtime component there is the number of individuals on one-to-ones. So the number of patients put on a one-to-one because of the behavioral discontrol, we don't have a surplus of staff to pull from. So staff have been forced on one-to-one. So we have an entire population of employees that are stressed as a result of the total number of overtime hours that they've been required on hand. And I think that is, we all need to understand that that's got to be part of this whole picture.
And what does that mean in terms of money then? So if people are on overtime hours, they're paying, what is it, time and a half? Or more than that?
Representative, overtime is time and a half. The actual cost, we benchmark our overtime across our system and strive to keep it below 2.5% of the total of staff expenditures. In St. Peter, I think it's running right now by 5 or 6%, so substantially over their benchmark.
Okay. Representative.
Thanks. So that's interesting, and again, NOCA is different than the St. Peter thing, but my locals tell me that they're actually getting their hours cut, and a lot of 80% staff times. And so I'm just confused about that. It just looks like to me fatigue is an issue. It's interesting that a third of your hours or so are forced overtime when the people would rather not. Yeah, if they were at 80%, they'd rather have some overtime, but people who are overworked are working too much, and people who are underemployed would like to work more. And welcome to the top, Dr. Sula.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, and also I'll direct this to Representative Morrow, because I know that there's great interest in this. There should not be any employees at ANOCA or at St. Peter, from my understanding, that would be have their hours reduced, because that model is being used only in areas in which the census was significantly lower. Both of those campuses are completely filled today. So there's not bed capacity. I mean, there's a waiting list to get into ANOCA. There's not bed capacity per se at ANOCA. So, I mean, if that's being described as something I want us to examine and take a look at, because it should be part of that picture.
We'll take that offline, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no, we can hear more about that. Why don't Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Swift, for coming, and I know there's a document that we passed out to everyone. Mr. Chair and members, you know, Dr. Sulik alluded to this. I'm deeply concerned, and one of the reasons I'm deeply concerned is that staff at the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center asked last week or so, at what desk does the buck stop on these issues? And they were told by senior management, you are never going to find it. Now, Dr. Sulik, I think the buck stops with you, ultimately.
To find senior management.
Well, I don't want to give people's names, so I could write it down for you if you like, and I gave you the names offline. But to be told that you're never going to be told where the buck stops is perhaps one of the roots of the problem. Mr. Chair, members, these are all emails from injured St. Peter Regional Treatment staff. You'll see on the document before you that this gets to Representative Abler's questions. From 2005 to 2009, Representative Abler, at the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center MSH, there's been a 408% increase in assaults, from 35 in 2005 to 143 last year. Mr. Chair and members, I've got a list here. 2010, forehead laceration, shoulder contusion, chest contusion. There have been people sent to the ER last year and this year. There's a member in our audience right now who was assaulted just in the past few days by a patient. What's going on at the regional Treatment Center in St. Peter? Representative Abler, you got to this. There are security counselors who are permanently disabled. Even there have been 1,300 lost work days in 2009. 1,300 lost work days due to patient assaults. The cost goes to the state. Lost time, medical bills, workers' comp, and overtime. And Representative Abler, I think you pointed to the overtime issue just a moment ago. What I hear from the staff when I meet with the staff, and I meet with the staff regularly, they complain of a management structure that's so cumbersome and so detached, it takes 15 months to get attention to issues. They raised this issue of patient assaults in 2008, and it's now 2010. They're still waiting to see manageable solutions, and in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I'm going to propose four steps that can be taken. Step number one. I think the management needs to review whether they continue to use the JNCO standards, especially when it comes to restraints and seclusions. Now, I may be describing this incorrectly, and I apologize, Dr. Sulik, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that restraint or seclusion could be used by a security counselor, but it's only temporary. That one of the, may have the term wrong here, but a psychiatrist has to approve the, especially the seclusion. What I've been hearing is that psychiatrists don't necessarily come to St. Peter. In fact, the staff may be as far away as the Twin Cities. And by telephone, they order the release from the seclusion. And so when we have the same patient committing numerous assaults, that might beg one of two questions. One, are we releasing people from seclusion too quickly? Is the process where we have a telephone review appropriate? And number three, why is the same patient allowed to assault people 40, 50, 60 times? And how are we going to address that? Number two, so number one, review this JNCO standards on restraint and seclusion. Number two, we need a clearly identified management person with the authority to speak to safety and violence concerns in a timely and effective manner. Being told that you're never going to find the table where the desk where the buck stops is an inappropriate and inexcusable sentence. Number three, the state needs to assure that current security counselor staffing minimums are maintained. This gets Representative Abler to your point in part. We have long layoff lists. People who want to work, at least at the St. Peter Center, I'm sorry, I can't speak to Anoka. At the same time, we're forcing other people to do overtime, which causes the very stress concerns that I'm grateful to Dr. Sulik for recognizing. And number four, I recognize that we have a serious budget problem, but we cannot further reduce the line staff security counselors within the MSH program. It's my understanding from speaking with Mr. Tesner, and if I get this wrong, Mr. Tesner, please correct me, that there is no current plan to reduce security counselors. I just want to confirm that it is the current plan. I thought a communication was going out to that effect, but I've not yet seen that communication. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll step aside. I'll answer any questions.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I think there was nodding on that, that there's no current plan.
I think I'll let Mr. Tesser say that.
Yep. Just first of that, is that the plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marr, that is the plan.
And Mr. Chair, that's one thing. I know that Mr. Greffey also has some things
yes.
to say about the assaults.
No, that why don't we do that? And if you want to sit at the table, you're welcome. Or you can stay there, too, but you can certainly ask questions, Representative Marr. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Griffey. My last name is spelled G-R-E-F-E. I know we were going to spend just a few minutes on this, so in the interest of time, I'm going to get right to the couple points I would like to make. I think Representative Morrow said a lot of things I was going to say. There was some interest in the overtime and what the cost of that overtime was. I do have those numbers, and we can leave some of this stuff with you if you would like.
That'd be helpful, but go ahead.
The overtime in 08 and 09 was just shy of $2.5 million, and that was after some layoffs occurred in the year of 2007. The local that I represent for ASME, it's local 404 down there, they have gone from about 800 members, a high of 800 members in about 2007, down to around approximately, and these are approximate numbers, around 600 now. And the other thing I'd like to say
and
is...
Can I just clarify, so on that $2.5 million, is that over the total overtime, or is that the halftime that's above...
That would be the total overtime number for 2008
and 2009. Right, and so that's the total amount, and yeah. So, okay.
It breaks down to approximately 44,000 hours in 2008 for $1.35 million, and then 32,000 some hours in 2009 for another $1,059,000.
Okay, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's way right. The other piece of this is, you know, we talked about this in labor management, and Representative Marl said it well, that, you know, this was brought up in December of 2008 as an issue, and has been going on for as many months since. And we have numbers up through the end of 2009. There's a piece here that in a single day, we had... On an evening, we had you know, an RN punch in the jaw. We had people out for 5 days with jammed fingers. We had people go to the emergency room, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on these assaults. The people that work in this facility understand that they're going to get bumps and bruises, and that it could be a dangerous place to work. The concern is that this tremendous spike that has happened. And people ending up hitting the floor in the emergency room. And Dr. Sulik makes a good point. They are doing long-term things to do those fixes. And, you know, I guess it will be waiting to see whether those work. But in the short term, this continues, and it has continued for quite some time. And I think we need something in the short term to make sure that the staff safety occurs while these long-term fixes either do or do not kick in, and I think.
And what can we do?
Well, I think there's a number of things. One of them is that, and by the way, before I took a job with ASME Council 5, I put approximately 16 years in this facility. So this is where I cut my teeth for the state of Minnesota. You know, looking from the outside in now compared to when I worked there, I think there is a distinct of loss of staff discretion on their ability to perform their job. Dr. Sulik alluded to that in his testimony, that that staff discretion, you know, people are hesitant to actually do what they're supposed to do when a critical situation happens. And I think that hesitancy is because of how they're going to be judged post-incident. And there are times that you really need to think quickly and critically, and make those decisions in those situations. And if they were going to think about how am I going to get in trouble after that, having the ability to act and act quickly has already been kind of
in trouble. In trouble in what way?
Oh, the restraint seclusion piece of this, when you get in a critical incident, I really see that there's a view of that being a failure in treatment if we restrain or seclude someone, and that's viewed as we did something wrong. It's a failure in treatment. Well, in my opinion, it's a failure in treatment if we have a client that's assaulting someone 40, 50 times, as Representative Morrow said. So I think the staff, you know, are afraid that they're going to be judged that this was a failure, and what could have been done, and how could he have handled that. They worry whether they're literally worry whether they're going to be disciplined or not after after something like that would happen.
And what about this on the staffing side, in terms of the number of staff or the overtime issues? I mean, do you have a sense of whether that has Is it more on kind of the, it's more on the restraint seclusion side and the impact of that as opposed to the how it's staffed?
Well, definitely the staffing side comes into play. Like I said, that this this local has been reduced significantly in numbers, and it has been the numbers that the reductions that have occurred have been in line staff, AFSCME bargaining unit staff. So I think that plays a role. I really think that the forced overtime plays a role. People getting inverse, working extra hours, working long hours,
and what does that mean? So that means you are working a shift from, and what would a typical shift be during the day? Like a 7 to 2. You end your shift switches at 2, right?
Yeah, it's a 24/7 operation. So a typical shifts would be a 6 to 2, 2 to 10, and a 10 to 6.
Okay, and so somewhere 6 to 2, and then what happens when you get to the inverse hour? So someone just then works a 16-hour straight?
If they are mandated or what they call inverse, then a person would have to work an additional 8 hours on the back of the 8 hours that they originally
worked. Okay, so it's not someone that gets called in. It could be someone that gets called in for an addition on a different day entirely, but sometimes people are working 16 hours through.
Yep, and it could be that someone would be called in, but that would depend on if it's overtime known in advance or if it would be a substitute shift.
Okay, Representative.
Well, I think this is a productive discussion, and it kind of lines up with a lot of the ones I've had over the years. And I have a question that I don't know how to address it or to which of the two people at the table, but when they ask me if folks stop in, we chat about their work, and these conversations are about like what we've been hearing. And then I talk about Dr. Stulik there, and I talk about his interest in patient care. I encourage him to go back, and that there's that he's there trying to redesign with the patients in mind, and thank you for their service. And I urge them to report things so they filter on up. I think there's a gap between the line worker and the head of the organization. And that would be something I think that comes out of this. And I don't know how many levels there are, but it doesn't seem to trickle up very far to get to the executive group that's trying to coordinate all these functions between, you got the civil courts, and you got Dr. Sulik, and all this stuff where they know what they're trying to do and their intent. But I just see a gap between them. Maybe it's just a comment and they can work on it, but I don't know. Do you want to each comment about that? I tell the asking folks, well, tell your supervisor and because I hear the administrative level all the time here, and I'm impressed with that. And so can you comment, Mr. Griefy, and maybe Dr. Sulik, both about what you see about the admin intermediaries?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, one of the things I would say is I actually had an opportunity to meet with Mr. Griffey.
Correct.
I'm saying that correct? Mr. Griffey and Representative Morrow in St. Peter, I think it was last September, and with some of the AFSCME leadership from the St. Peter campus, and it was clear to me that there was a gap in the awareness of some of the experience of the individual employees that was not occurring, and it was not rising up to Mr. Tesner's understanding or my understanding. And there has been some attempts to try to create some mechanisms for communication and for engagement with employees on the campus. From that meeting, we talked about the fact that there needed to be the administrative staff on that campus needed to implement some exercises of getting much more engaged with the employees. They started listening sessions. And I'll tell you that I've been getting feedback from the management on that campus that they're starting to see some progress in staff morale. They're starting to see some progress in the reduction of overtime and the reduction of staff injuries. And as I look at this chart, I see January and February, we're getting back a little bit in the right direction. But, I want to see 0 at that top row. I don't want to see 7, but it's certainly not 16 or 13. But I also recognize that it takes an enormous amount of time when changes start to occur for people to feel those changes are actually occurring. And I don't know if they're still reeling back from just the stress that is on this campus. And so even if we were at 0, we could still be stressed on that campus. I don't have the answer to that, but I think that that's one of the things that I need to understand in this process.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Sulik, what you described is accurate. We did meet in the fall, and I would just offer one invitation. There are a number of folks here from St. Peter, and you could have that unfiltered or unmediated discussion with them to see what their thoughts are of the process post-September.
Sure. Well, I'll be, Mr. Chair, Representative Moore, in the hall right after this hearing if people want to stay and share some thoughts with me. I'd be happy to do that.
Any other questions that members have on this subject? And I think we'll, you know, come back to this. I mean, I do think that this question of who, you know, is, if there's an identified person that's taking this issue on within at the campus level, would make some sense if we could get an answer, you know, kind of some thinking about that. And I know that Representative Morrow will continue to work on this, but thank you for coming to talk about this. So, and the plan just kind of going forward here is we have some time scheduled both tomorrow and Thursday. We'll have to talk about this to kind of go through some more because we're not going to be able to finish everything up here. The one other thing that I'd like to do though before we move on is there folks here who are not here every, I know there's people here who are not here every day, but if there are people here who are not here every day that want to, are on the list of testifiers that we should kind of get in to talk about this? Why don't we go to that? And it's going to be a little strange before the overview, but I think if we could do that, I think it would be helpful.
Absolutely.
So why don't you come on up? Oh, yeah. So we have minutes from the March 17th meeting. Representative, you moves. All in favor of those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome to the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the committee, yes, we're looking for a chair.
We got it.
We've got one. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I know you see my face here at the Capitol, but we have some nurses that would like to testify today, and I just want to introduce the topic. My name is Mary Jo George with the Minnesota Nurses Association, and we represent 400 of the registered nurses statewide that work in mental health through the state-operated services. We appreciate all this attention to safety in the regional treatment centers, although our comments today are on the redesign, although we will address some of the safety issues as well. We just want to express our grave concerns with the redesign that you haven't heard about yet, because we do believe that the plan will decimate services to people with mental illness and result in numerous job losses for state employees, including RNs. And joining me today is Linda Rasso, who will talk about the Mankato Crisis Center that is slated to close, and also Becky Ramos, who will talk about gaps in the services and the redesign plan that we see. I think from our perspective, what we see is most troubling about the report is the appalling lack of detail with the plan. Many of the proposals are to be developed without a cost or a timeline for implementation. And without the detail, I think it's very difficult to understand what the impact is for nurses and for patients. At this point, we have more questions than answers. One of them is, where will the patients be transferred to when we are slated to close some of these facilities? And where will the cuts to the jobs come from? At this point, it looks like it's 200 FTEs, which is approximately 300 jobs. The information, again, we're receiving from DHS is very chaotic manner. We just got notice that there will be 91 layoffs. 23 of those are RN positions, and many of these are being given the notice as soon as April 7th and to be transferred by the end of the month. Other questions that we have are, what are the new levels of care centers? What are these PERTs? How are they licensed? How are they billed? And how are they staffed? We do not have a lot of information. We learned last week at the Senate hearing that there are stakeholder meetings on this very topic this week, And I am happy to say that I have been invited to those meetings tomorrow. Other comments that we do have is preserve what is working. You'll hear from Linda Rosso today that some of these programs are working. And the other comment we have is try to improve on what we already have. I think the CBHHs need a lot of improvement, and we don't see that in the redesign. In addition to the Mankato and Wilmer programs, our nurses at Eveleth are telling us that that is a unique program, often serving clients with long-term needs who are difficult to place. They do feel that they've been successful in breaking the repeated cycle of ambulance, use of emergency rooms, and rehospitalizations. So we'd urge you to look more closely at that program. And finally, with the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, we have over 100 RNs employed in this facility, and we want to be part of the solution to change. Although we do think it's ironic that the overall plan doesn't have any recommendations for Anoka, even though this legislature directed DHS to come up with solutions on that. And given the looming nursing shortage, we do support the current law that does call for no layoff language at the Anoka campus. And so with that, I'm going to hand it over to Becky or Linda. Linda, do you want to go? And then Becky. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. And if you could just say your name before you start. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Linda Rossell. I've been a psychiatric RN for 18 years, and I actually work at the hospital in Mankato, so I'm not affected by state-operated services directly, but indirectly I will be greatly affected. And I'm here on behalf of the Nurses Association and the patients that I serve. On February 4th, I attended the state-operated services redesign stakeholder meeting in Mankato. It was one of several that were held around the state. There were 74 other participants who were there from across the region. This meeting was represented by state-operated services as a request for input into the redesign of state-operated services. The participants were asked what was working, what needed to be changed to better meet the needs of our region, and I have 8 pages of notes that came out of that meeting. And it doesn't seem like they really listened. Because we told them what was working well. The bottom line was that the 10 County Safety Initiative Group is working well, and they have created numerous working relationships that include the 2 hospitals in the region that have behavioral health units, the private and public providers in the region, nursing, law enforcement, consumers, and county staff. The South Central Crisis Center was a result of gathering input from all the members of the Safety Initiative Group over a 2-year period, and I actually sat on that group at that time. The role of the Crisis Center has evolved over the past 4 years since it came into operation, and the closing of the Crisis Center will be felt most by our patients. Emmanuel St. Joe's Mayo Health System, which is where I work, has the largest ER in the region, and we triage many individuals with mental health issues. Prior to the opening of the Crisis Center in 2006, it was normal for us to transfer 30 to 40 patients per month to other state hospitals or to other hospitals in the state. 30 to 40 patients per month were transferred out of our ER somewhere else because we were full. Since that time, with the opening of the Crisis Center, we were able to provide patients with the right level of care at the right time, closer to home. And now we're down to where it's maybe 10 to 12 patients per month that are transferred elsewhere, because many of the patients who show up go to the Crisis Center. Currently, ISJ sends about 12 patients per month from the hospital to the Crisis Center for admission. And in 2009, the Crisis Center averaged 29 bridging appointments per month, primarily from ISJ and other hospitals that were in the area. Bridging appointments are when patients aren't able to get in to see their provider in a reasonable amount of time. So we see them at the Crisis Center, and then they get to their provider later on. In addition, the ISJ clinics and hospital referred individuals 20 times per month for urgent care appointments. So how does the Crisis Center serve our patients? I'm going to give you a few examples. there's a patient who no longer needs to be in our hospital unit. We're an acute crisis stabilization unit, and that's what we were designed to do. But they need a transition to go home. They can't go directly from our unit to home. Not everything's in place. We've started the process, but they're not ready to go home. We call the crisis center. We say, do you have beds? Can we send people there for a day or two, up to 10 days? And then the people go home independently from the crisis center. A patient could be discharging from the hospital, and they can't be seen by their provider for med management for 2 to 3 months. The crisis center was doing bridging appointments. So they would see that patient up until the time they got to their provider. Someone's in the ER, and they're in crisis, but they really don't meet criteria for being hospitalized. We would call the crisis center. The crisis center may need just to set up an appointment, an urgent care appointment. They could be seen within a few hours, a day or two, and they would see that patient, get the patient on the road to getting connected up. It provides a safe place for them to stay for a day, up to 10 days, until they can get resources lined up for them. And they also provided 77 individuals an opportunity to talk to somebody, might be a social worker, it might be a nurse, and their crisis was resolved in less than 3 hours. They went to talk to somebody, they got connected up, they got follow-up. We also had a situation at our hospital. We do electroconvulsive therapy, which is ECTs, and we were able to provide with the crisis center a place for people to do those as an outpatient when they didn't have the opportunity because they had nobody at home who could provide transportation for them or care for several hours after that ECT. They're not allowed to drive for 24 hours. They're not allowed to be alone for several hours after that because their memory problems right after that. So we were able to provide with the crisis center. They actually would bring the people to the ECT, monitor them for several hours. Afterwards, their family may then pick them up and take them home for the night, bring them back a couple of days later for a repeat, because they do several. So we might do a couple in the hospital, monitor them, make sure they're not having any adverse effects. Then they would go to the crisis center and finish up their treatment, which might take a couple of weeks. But it's intermittent, so they didn't have to stay there. The St. Peter CBHH is not the solution to what we need to do if those services are no longer provided by the crisis center. First and foremost, the physician, psychiatrist that works at the CBHH, some of the advanced practice nurses that work at the CBHH, found out this proposal by reading it in the newspaper. They were not asked if they could provide those services. They found out from other sources. And you can't mix subacute populations with acute populations because you do a disservice to both groups. We have, on our unit, a mixed population. We have one wing of the hospital. We have psychotic individuals, geriatric individuals who have dementia. We have young adults who are very aggressive. We have people who are just there for depression and just dysfunctional. I mean, we have everybody and every type of severity of illness, and it's very difficult to do on our unit. And we used to be able to transfer people who were extremely aggressive to the St. Peter campus, not the CBHH. They're even less equipped than we are. They have fewer resources than we do. And I wouldn't work there. You couldn't pay me enough to work at a CBHH. The CBHH is struggling with unsafe conditions for patients and staff related to the increase in violence. We're seeing it on our acute unit and the severity of mental illness. It's really bad. The provider staff at the CBHH in St. Peter is a 16-bed operation, but they've very seldom been able to operate at 16 beds because of the lack of psychiatric coverage. They're usually capped at 8 to 12. So my question is, how are you going to expand their responsibilities when they already have inadequate staff? And they also don't have the space to take on a subacute population and provide any of those type of appointments. They'd have to build on. So where's the cost savings? The majority of clients served at the crisis center are from Mankato. Bluard County, being the largest county in that area, serves about 680 patients. Rice County serves 15. okay? So when you move us out of Mankato to St. Peter, people will say, oh, that's only 10 miles away. Well, within Mankato, we have bus transportation, we have cabs, they can actually walk. You know, they can find somebody, case manager, somebody might be able to take them. I can get anywhere in Mankato in 10 to 15 minutes. Doesn't matter how far you live. To get to St. Peter, we have no bus transportation from Mankato to St. Peter. So how are people going to get from Mankato to St. Peter? We have nothing. If you have to put something in place, again, there's going to be a cost. And the people that I deal with don't own cars, don't know people that own cars, except for their case managers, their county workers, and so we're going to have the county workers on the road constantly, and then they're not going to be able to service their clients. And they don't have the funds to pay for a cab. It would be quite expensive. Just to go the 10 miles would be very expensive. And so finally, I believe that shifting the $17 million savings that State Operated Services wants to save to a $17 million cost to the counties, community hospitals, and the patients in our region is really not the solution either. And the bottom line is that the patients are the ones who will pay the price.
Any questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning. My name is Rebecca Ramos. I work at CBHH in Annandale currently. I was temporarily reassigned from Cold Spring, which now will be closed. So we are not really sure where we're sitting. I have worked over 20 years for the state of Minnesota in mental health. And I have also worked at some at the Wilmer CBHH. The three design processes have been going on for a period of time, but I don't feel that we've been kept informed or we have been involved in what could be done with this. The treatment aspect of the CBHH is compromised due to reduced staff, which creates an atmosphere of a crisis intervention unit rather than a treatment unit. We often find the staff putting out fires instead of being able to spend time with the patients to help them deal with challenges and give them ideas as how they might be able to meet those challenges. You'll have to excuse me, I worked night watch last night and drove in from Annandale and got stuck in construction. So I'm having a hard time seeing here. With the proposed job losses, we are not only losing seasoned staff, but we're losing many young, new staff that have some new and fresh ideas. And that's really disconcerting because we're missing out on that for the patients. It's difficult to ascertain what plans are in process to handle the mentally ill and aggressive client at this time or the more fragile or geriatric client. We're not sure what's going to happen with them. Things have been said verbally. It's real difficult. I work a night watch shift. So for me to go to a meeting to Annandale, which is an hour and a half from my home right now, I would have to turn around from my home or stay in Annandale and go to the meeting. So it's not a situation for me to go back for a meeting. So I'm taking information from people that have attended those meetings. We are losing the focus of patient-centered care, and I think we're looking at fiscal-centered care. And I don't really see much benefit for the patients in that system. So there are changes alluded to in the admission process. I think that's really necessary. The central admission process, in my aspect, is looking at more of a triage process. When the patient actually gets to a CBHH is when the admission process occurs, and that could take anywhere from 2 hours to 6 hours to complete, depending upon the patient, depending upon their paranoia, depending upon their level of cooperation, and depending upon the computers. I did work in Wilmer CBHH on Sunday night. Wilmer had 14 patients at that time. They have consistently been running between 12 and 14 patients. They have two licensed practitioners that can take care of those patients. They have a number of staff, more staff than Annandale has right now, and they are being cut down to a PERT, which means they're going to be losing positions, and it looks like it'd be 13 positions that they'll be losing at that facility alone, which is real disconcerting. I don't know how these new proposed programs are going to be staffed. How is the state going to provide 24/7 psychiatric care when they can't fill positions right now? We really do care deeply for our patients. I've got a son who has Asperger's. If he had to be in a facility, which he has not had to be, he's a college graduate, I would be very reluctant to put him into a CBHH at this point, simply because we are mixing, like Linda said, the acute and subacute, and you can't do justice to either one. You have aggressive clients or loud clients or clients that are scary to some of the individuals, and those individuals isolate in their rooms and they miss out on their treatment. And we see that consistently. We're sitting in Annandale is temporarily reassigned. We've got people working there that are from Annandale, and nobody knows what's going to happen. Yet something's going to happen in April, and somehow we're going to have to make some decision about what we're going to do. We don't know what that is. It's very difficult to have any kind of positive morale when you look at that situation. It's a tough situation. And we were entered into the Annandale system about 6 months ago. So now we find out that we're not going to be able to go back to Cold Spring. And we're temporarily reassigned in Annandale, and all the Annandale people and us are there, and nobody knows what's going on. It's very difficult. It's extremely tiresome to watch the whole thing progress. We've had people that have left, staff that have left. So our questions can continue to go either under-answered or unanswered. We can't seem to get a real handle on what's going on. So I would like people to have a little more consideration for some of the most vulnerable residents of Minnesota are mentally ill, and I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. That's helpful. Yeah, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen, and I am here representing MAPE. I am a licensed psychologist at Minnesota Extended Treatment Options. I've worked for the state of Minnesota for 30 years, and I've actually worked with people with developmental disabilities and related conditions for about 31 years. So I've got a fairly intimate knowledge of the treatment needs of this very vulnerable population. As you may know, as the state of Minnesota was deinstitutionalizing its population of persons with DD and related conditions, a few individuals at state-operated services years ago had the foresight to look at other states to see what occurred with this population following their deinstitutionalization when the individuals posed a risk to others or themselves. And what they found was people with developmental disabilities or related conditions often ended up in jail, prisons, or mental health institutions where their full treatment needs were not met, perhaps not identified, and they were extremely vulnerable in those situations. So the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options was created to ensure that this very vulnerable population was afforded the security of commitment and appropriate treatment when they were deemed a risk to public safety or themselves. I'm pretty much here advocating on behalf of this population. Since 1999, MEDO has served persons with DD and related conditions. And what it does is it provides the counties of Minnesota with a safety net that is there when a behavioral crisis occurs that results in the community placement of the individual no longer being a safe option. MEDO has a proven track record with actually recidivism rates of less than 12%, which is an incredibly good recidivism rate, with an average treatment stay of 12 to 18 months. I can give you some numbers. Fiscal year 09, the average stay was 0.84 years. Fiscal year 10 thus far, higher, 1.54 years. But for the most part, we've done a really good job of providing the treatment needs of the individuals and getting them back into the community. And the community process that they're when they get discharged, it's really driven by the county. When we deem them ready, sometimes there's a latency between when we deem them ready and when the county has been able to find available options for the individual. But what's really important, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that this treatment that MEDOs provide is across a number of disciplines and stretches far beyond psychiatric pharmaceutical interventions. It's highly specialized for this very special population. It's done in the context of Minnesota's consolidated rules in order to augment transition to the private sector providers who operate under those same rules. Integral in that context is the vocational component that MEDO provides, in that the root of many of the behavioral issues that send them to us occur in the context of that vocational program. Oftentimes, we've had individuals who unfortunately have ended up in mental health facilities where there are no demands of the normal working day. Pharmaceuticals occur. They seem very stable. They come back to us. And the same type of situation to be in a community, we provide at MEDO. They get into the stressors of going to the work situation every day, and we have to treat them in that context. In addition to treatment for the individual, MEDO has provided training for the private sector providers receiving MEDO discharges in order to facilitate a successful return to the community. MEDO is a 48-bed capacity and has met or come close to that level of population in the past. MEDO, as of this Monday, has 30 consumer beds. A week ago, I could say 31 beds occupied, with an entire building, 12 beds closed and not funded, although MEDO is currently budgeted for only 21 beds.
What does that mean? What does that mean? You're only funded for 21 beds?
That was the amount of funding that we had. We've been operating over because of the intense number of commitments to us that we have received. So that's what we were budgeted for.
Okay, so you've hired more staff to deal with the additional.
We've had the staffing ratios to do so, but as a result, we're operating over budget.
Right. Okay.
And that is precisely the reason. State Operated Services has proposed changing MEDO to a 16-bed facility with 2 4-to-5-bed foster homes for transition. This would limit the capacity of MEDO to serve the counties of Minnesota with only 16 campus beds, significantly less than what the current needs are based upon our current population, and we also have a host of referrals that we're not now able to entertain. It's also unknown how the proposal as a PERT would affect the MEDO staffing ratios, as the current levels are necessary to stabilize the individual in the aforementioned context, consolidated rules, vocational, in preparation for treatment and discharge. If MEDO's full, where would these very vulnerable persons go when their private providers can no longer serve them and they risk present a risk to public safety? What's important also to realize is that and this is data from a week ago, of the 31 individuals who are at MEDO, 17 of those were committed only as developmentally disabled. And that's a real important context if we're talking going to a PERT, which is a psychiatric type of facility.
So they're developmentally disabled, but they're there because they also have aggression?
Well, basically, they've met the standard that allows their county to commit them. Typically, it's aggression. Sometimes it can be directed towards themselves. The bottom line is they have been deemed a risk to public safety, either to others or themselves, need the protection that commitment provides. And thus, when they get committed to Department of Human Services, typically if they're developmentally disabled, they would come to us. As I mentioned, and I'll just reiterate, of the 31 that we had as of a week ago Monday, 17 of those were solely committed as developmentally disabled.
And is that the real purpose of MEDO?
The real purpose of MEDO was to serve persons with developmental disability who are deemed a risk to public safety, kind of like, basically, when other states deinstitutionalized, they looked at them and saw many individuals ended up, unfortunately, being in jails, prisons, mental health facilities, even needs not being met. Great foresight occurred. Let's take care of this very vulnerable population so that doesn't occur.
Who are the other 14 then?
The other 14 are committed as both developmentally disabled and mentally ill.
Oh, so, okay.
So.
And is that the appropriate place for them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, due to their developmental disability, because what we found, and I emphasized slightly earlier, was their treatment extends far beyond pharmaceutical psychiatric standardized treatment.
Okay.
So. The highly specialized treatment oriented towards the developmental disabilities and related conditions is not replicated in any setting in Minnesota that affords the degree of public safety that MEDO currently has. This is going to leave county case managers without a viable option for their DD client, leaving the individual quite vulnerable. In order to advocate for the special needs of this very special population when they're at risk to others or themselves, the counties that are out there, and I think many of the county case managers serving this population can affirm this, need the bed space and staffing treatment resources that MEDO currently provides. And I said this to the Senate committee previously, it's going to sound corny, but I truly, truly believe it, is that Minnesota's got a real glorious history of serving people that can't really take care of themselves. And so to have this very special population vulnerable because their treatment needs aren't met, when MEDO has been limited to 16 campus beds, when the need obviously currently is at 30 or greater, we could actually fill quite a few more beds, is really unfortunate. So I just want to make sure that the state of Minnesota continues to serve this very vulnerable population. Okay. And excuse my drama.
No. Thank you very much for coming. Any questions? Okay. Sandy Johnson is also here. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
If it would be okay, I could have Sue come with me. Sue and I are colleagues in different areas.
So that would be fine. And okay. They've also, you've come, what, 3 hours?
We have.
Okay.
I'm not a really good speaker, so bear with me.
You'll do great.
My name is Sandy Johnson. I am from Fergus Falls, Minnesota. I've been a dental assistant for 40 years, 35 years in the private sector, and the last 5 years with the state-operated services. We are very concerned with the closing of our dental offices, Fergus, Cambridge, and Wilmer. There are only 5 of our offices in existence, and we serve the developmentally disabled patients. And there is no way that the private sector can see our patients. Our normal day consists of hygiene patients and myself working with the dentist. The patients come with group home staff, and they do help us. We do restraining in our office, and we have a hospital dentistry program, the only 2 in the state. The other one is Faribault that works on Wednesday. But there is no way that a private dental office can see the patients that we see. I mean, it is not unusual for us to have accidents. These people that bring patients in are responsible for feeding their patients, brushing their teeth, and every bodily function that they do. And sometimes 2 or 3 times a week, we have this happen in our office. I am trying to be a voice for these people because I have worked in the private sector. There is no way that it can be done. And our hospital program sees the very severely disabled patients. I go there on Wednesdays with my doctor. We have not since January, as he's deployed halfway around the world right now for 120 days. And we see the very severe patients, or the ones that have extensive work done in the hospital, in the surgical atmosphere. And so we're trying to make a plea to save our 5 state offices.
Thank you. Yeah.
My colleague Sue.
Yeah, and if you just want to slide the microphone over, maybe that won't work. Sorry. Okay.
But thank you, though. My name is Sue Fields, and I work as a dental assistant at the Health Source Dental Clinic. I've been a dental assistant for 35 years, 22 of which have been working with the state at the Health Source Dental Clinic. The purpose of our clinic is to bring healthy smiles to the developmentally disabled. This population would have a difficult time in traditional dental offices. To paint this picture a little more clearly, I have been spit on, had snot blown on me, thrown up on, cleaned up body excrement from the floor. And I'm not telling you this to complain. I love people. I love to serve. That's why I work here in this clinic. In a traditional dental office, they probably would not be seen. They also come great distances. Several years ago, we were able to see people as far away as Rosso, Ely, the Northern Tier. Then they wanted to separate those out, so some went to Brainerd. I don't know where some of the others. Fergus Falls, Brainerd. But I think they should have the option to go wherever that they choose to go on these five clinics. Dental is very important to these patients. They have increased dental problems because of their behaviors. A lot of it is not so much the decay as it is gum disease. They need to have regular cleanings, and they need to have cleanings more often because they're combative. The group homes are not able to get the cleanings done. They cannot hold them to brush their teeth. So if they are too combative, more than likely they won't get their teeth brushed. All of medical assistance includes the DD population. With the latest cuts to the medical assistance, root canals on molar teeth cannot be covered even for children and pregnant women. So no molar teeth will have root canals. If they don't have the cash to pay, the teeth get pulled. Full mouth set of x-rays, only one every 6 years. This is the dentist's biggest diagnostic tool. Now, some we cannot get it on unless they are in a hospital setting, and there they can take full mouth set of x-rays every 2 years. Some other cuts was only the cleaning once a year. Behavior modification was another cut. That's something that we used a great deal, not a large percentage. General anesthesia at an oral surgeon's clinic cannot be given. So now if we have a combative patient who needs a tooth out, it's a difficult extraction. If they can't pay for the general anesthesia, the oral surgeon office that we deal with said, I'm sorry, we won't be able to see it. It's about $200 for general anesthesia. When we ask the guardians for permission, they say for on a fee-for-service basis, we can have them come back for cleaning. This is what it'll cost. They say, I'm sorry, my patient doesn't have the money. Therefore, they are not seen. We can see them for emergencies. So when they're nonverbal, what constitutes an emergency? Gentleman came in the other day. He said, yeah, my tooth kind of hurts. He hadn't been in since November. He's come back for a regular cleaning. Well, the tooth broke. Yeah, there's a pain there. They can fix the tooth. The state-run clinics are exclusive in that respect. That's all we work on is the DD population. I don't believe getting reimbursed by medical assistance, we're ever going to make money. Where the money comes from, I don't have a clue. But I know that there is a need there. This is the lowest of the low. They had a university physician's clinic that they wanted us to refer people to. Never really said why we were to refer people there. The clinic said we cannot use medical protective devices. You send us a form. If we say they can come, then they can come. After that form is sent out and it's reviewed by them, either the group home or the guardian or whoever has to call there within a month, or they throw that referral out. Will it serve some patients? Yes, there will be some that can go there. HCMC, yes, they have hospitalization, but you send somebody every 2 years for cleaning, and that's it, because there isn't another dental office that will take them.
We see patients 3 and 4 hours away, and we had a father, I mean, yesterday he looked at me, he was lifting his 24-year-old daughter out of the chair, and she had a twisted body, and I could have just about cried. He said, where am I going to take my daughter? The doors are closed to her. What am I supposed to say to these people? I don't know.
Well, that's what we're here to try to figure out.
I hope you can find some room.
Yeah, and thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thank you for coming down today.
Thank you very much for your
okay. So, this didn't quite work out the way we had planned it. Because of caucus and time, we're going to have to end up here at this point. Although I think covering that staffing was a good or important place for us to start. So, what we'll do is we will let you know in the next hour or two, we'll put out another notice of when we'll reconvene. I really apologize for that, but I think we got a good sense of some of the questions that, and I'm sure you have others that have come up. Thank you all for coming today, and we'll continue to it'll be sometime hopefully later this week. Okay, thank you. We are adjourned.